translation. Although you have no knowledge, you have become a so-called learned person, and therefore you dare to be so impudent as to disobey my order. Because of disobeying me, you shall very soon be bereft of all your opulence. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that Balimraj was not Pandita Mani, or one who falsely assumes himself learned. Rather, he was Pandita Manyagya, one who is so learned that all other learned persons worship him. And because he was so learned, he could disobey the order of his so-called spiritual master. He had no fear of any condition of material existence. Anyone cared for by Lord Vishnu does not need to care about anyone else. Thus, Balimraj could never be bereft of all opulences. The opulences offered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead are not to be compared to the opulences obtained by Karma Kanda. In other words, if a devotee becomes very opulent, it is to be understood that his opulence is a gift of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such opulence will never be vanquished. Whereas the opulence achieved by one's fruit of activity may be vanquished at any moment. I was born blinded by the darkness of ignorance, but my spiritual masters, they are opening my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge, and I offer my humble obeisances unto them. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Srimate Shivaram Swami Nityanamine. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Srimate Hridayananda Swami Nityanamine. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Nityanamine. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharani Nirvishesha Shunyavada Paskacha Dishtarani. Mukam karoti vachalam pangam langaite girim yad kripa tamaham vande shri gurun dinatarnam. Vande shri krishna chaitanya nityananda sahodito gaudadaya prishpanvanto chitra shanda tamonado. Offer my humble obeisances unto Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, who have risen simultaneously over the horizon of Gaudadesh, just like the sun and the moon, to dissipate the darkness of ignorance and to wonderfully bestow benediction upon all. Narayanam namaskritya naram chava narottamam devim sarasvatim vyasam tato jayam adhirayat nashta prayasho badrashu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavatir tamashlokhe bhaktir bhavati nashtaki. Dridam panditam manyagya stabda syasmad upekshaya mach chasana tigo yastvam achirad brashyase shriyaha. Although you have no knowledge, you have become a so-called learned person, and therefore you dare to be so impudent as to disobey my order. Because of disobeying me, you shall very soon be bereft of all your opulence. First point I'm going to address is the tone of voice being used here. I had a brainstorming of this verse last night with Brajasundri, and that's what she sort of noticed. So I'm representing her analysis in one sense in this first stage of my class. The tone of voice is very, it's very aggressive. And it's very condescending, and it's very arrogant. He's making, Shukracharya, Haribol said, is making these sweeping statements, and he's assuming so much. First, he says, you have no knowledge. So this indicates a material mentality straight away. The whole Western paradigm is that things have a beginning and have an end. There are, things are analysed as, is this right, is this wrong? Is this good, is this bad? It's black or it's white. You have no knowledge or you have, you know, all knowledge. It's not, it's completely an unreasonable statement to say you have no knowledge. Why doesn't he break it down? Why doesn't he get into some, useful analysis and say, well, in this respect, you're showing a lack of knowledge, but in this respect, you have a valid point. Why doesn't he break it down? Because his intelligence is not functioning. This shloka, this verse, indicates an entirely a consciousness that's entirely covered by the modes of nature, by emotional attachment. We know that from the Bhagavad Gita, avritam jnanametina jnanino nityaverina kamarupena kontya dusparena nalena cha. It says, thus the pure consciousness of the living entity is covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust. And we know that lust isn't referring to just the sexual dimension. Lust is referring to any emotional attachment. So it could be referring, like in this case, it's very much an attachment to power, to being the authority. Further on, he says, so-called learned person. Of course, in the purport, it's clarified that it's not that Bali Maharaj is the so-called learned person. He's the so-called, indicates falsely so. So-called learned, you're actually not. You're falsely appearing to be that, but you're not. But as it says in the purport, the clarification is there. He is actually a learned person, and it's Shukracharya who is the so-called spiritual master. And then this word impudent. So that's very, very condescending. He's actually descending to name calling. And then there's at the end he's threatening him. You know, as a result of this, you'll be bereft of all your opulence. So, you know, when a person's in a position of authority and they see that the person that they're in charge of has committed an error or has made a mistake, then there's a certain attitude that that authority needs to adopt if they're going to successfully correct the person they're in charge of. Recently I read this book by Purnachandra called Unspoken Obstacles on the Path to Bhakti. So he addresses this point where he says, it's a very nice point. He says, he's analyzing this word authority, and he says that the word authority not only indicates a position, but it must also mean that love is present. To be true authorities, parents must love their children. To get a proper response, a teacher must love his students. To help his disciples, a guru must love them. A king must love his subjects, and a husband must love his wife, for her to accept his authority. Then he elaborates in a couple of pages on. Of course, shades of grey exist between these dark and brilliant systems of ruling others. But basically there are these two approaches to motivating people. There are two kinds of people, Sura or Asura. There are also two approaches to governing people. One, by fear, and two, by love. Fear means the absence of love. Where there is fear, there is no love. So that's, he's saying that there are these two systems of authority. And we're being given, right here in this verse, an example of that system of authority that is based on fear. It's based on dogmatic roles. You know, I'm in charge, and you do what I tell you to do, and you don't ask questions. It's that sort of relationship. So I remember once, I don't know how old I was, maybe after school, like 12 years old, I used to watch this Superman series. And Superman's always defeating the gangsters, and there was this kind of comic depiction of the gangsters. And so I remember there was this kind of interaction where the boss of the gangsters, he'd be saying, "Oh, how are we going to get out of this spot? This is a difficult situation we're in." And then one of them says, "I know, boss. Why don't we attack from behind and get them from behind?" And then the boss slaps him across the face and says, "Who's the boss around here? I'm the boss." He goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, boss." And then the boss goes, "Hey, why don't we attack from behind and get them by surprise?" And the guy goes, "Yeah, great idea, boss. Why didn't I think of that?" And the guy goes, "Because you're not the boss, that's why." Something like that. That's how they would interact. So Sukracharya is saying, "I'm the boss. You can't correct me." And that's a weakness. That's a weakness in any relationship, actually. That means that the mechanism for purifying the relationship is not there. Now, even Krishna shows us that he's not above being given good advice and taking good advice. We know that he would take advice from Uddhava. And trying to think of any other examples. Can anyone think of other examples of exalted personalities taking advice? Originally, Krishna was saying yes. Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you, Narasimha. Yeah. There are these examples that someone, because the point of any if there's any dispute between two parties, the point should be to find the truth. Not that, you know, because I'm the boss, what I say goes. Who cares about the truth? The goal should be to find the truth. Many times, I mean, all Sankirtan devotees will experience this. You're having a discussion with somebody, you've just met them on the street, and if their ego is too out of control, they cannot hear the right conclusion. Of course, you know, we know that for knowledge to be for the truth to actually manifest, for knowledge to be found, there has to be the qualified speaker and the qualified hearer. And as soon as there's lack of humility, either on behalf of the speaker or the hearer, then the truth will not manifest. The truth simply recedes, and it's just a matter of who's going to win the argument. You know, it becomes, as Prabhupada gave the example, a case of either scissors or Well, was it scissors or paper, was it? Or rock? The two people were having an argument. Can you remember? It was scissors and what was the other one? Rock. Yeah. No, it was just scissors and rock. Two people were having an argument, and one was saying, it's scissors, and the other one was saying, no, no, it's rock. I'm sure everyone's heard this, but it's worth it repeating. It's a great story. Prabhupada tells it himself. So they're having this incredible heated argument, whether it's scissors or whether it's rock. And the guy who's attached to the conclusion being rock says, listen, it's rock. And if you don't accept that it's rock, I'm throwing you in that river. And the guy goes, well, it's scissors. And so he picked him up and threw him in the river. And the guy couldn't even swim. And so he's floundering. And then just before he went down and drowned, he put his hand up through the water and went like this. Scissors. Stubborn. That's the mentality of people when this, as it says, avritam gyanametina, when the intelligence is covered. This is the danger that somebody will die with a misconception. And in the Bhagavatam it says that those who practice devotional service, who follow this process of Krishna consciousness, they do not die with a misconception. They're not susceptible to misconceptions. They will have the right conception at the time of death, or at any time. So, one other sort of way of approaching this verse is that in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada analyzes language, and he says that there are these three stages of understanding language. So he says there is this stage of mukhya vritti, which is where it's the literal understanding. It's the obvious meaning, what something obviously means. And then there is called the mukhya vritti, the obvious understanding, the primary meaning of something. And then there is the gona vritti, which is the indirect meaning. When it's not clear what something means, then you go to this next stage of gona vritti. So it says, the example that's given is that if, for instance, you see a statement, the village was situated on the Ganges River. So you know that they haven't built a village on top of the water. It's not on the Ganges, it's beside, on the bank of the Ganges. So you actually then, because the primary meaning is not obvious, you can't take it on its face value. Then you go to the secondary level of meaning. And then there's another approach, which is called the Lakshana Vritti. So that means that the meaning is actually metaphorical. It can't be taken literally. In the fight, Bhima was a lion. He didn't turn into a lion. He wasn't a lion. He had the qualities of a lion. So it's to be taken metaphorically and not literally. In the absence of the obvious meaning, then in order to get to the correct conclusion, then you go to the secondary meaning, and if that's not obvious, you go to a third tertiary meaning. But when the obvious meaning is there, you always take that obvious meaning. If you're honest and if you have integrity. But of course, you know, Prabhupada said some people try and screw out a meaning out of Bhagavad Gita or out of scripture. They try and screw their own meaning out of it. So people, when they're screwing their own meaning out of it, what they're doing is they're ignoring the obvious meaning of something, and then they're going to the secondary or the third, and then they might even get to the fourth or the fifth, and then they finally get what they want, and they say, this is what it means. And that's how, you know, when we see in the Vedas, there is provision for things like meat eating and intoxication and sex, even illicit sex. There are provisions there. Because if people are not on a sufficiently pure consciousness, the Vedas don't just reject them out of hand. You know, this isn't the Vedas, again, it's not just black or white. The Vedas have got this very holistic approach. It's not in or out, you're good or bad. It takes all the, Purnachandra said it, all the shades of meaning are incorporated. So, insincere people, they will ignore that primary level of meaning. So, when we see what's going on in this verse, what's the primary level of responsibility of the spiritual master? That primary level is to take the disciple back to Godhead, is to connect them to Krishna. And if that disciple is not on that level, then the spiritual master will go to a secondary level, right? You're not ready for pure devotional service, so let's engage you in mixed devotional service or indirect devotional service. The Bhagavad Gita also, in chapter 12, explains how this works. That, you know, if you're not ready for pure devotional service, then da-da-da-da-da, etc. Even at the point where just be a good person, just give in charity, be moral. Don't worry about the spiritual stuff at this point. You know, that'll come, as soon as you establish a good character, then that'll inevitably come. And it's a fact, it's just to digress for a moment, I've been quite fascinated recently to notice that in the Bhagavatam it explains that it's almost like there's a mechanistic, it explains that there's almost this mechanistic sequence that leads us to spiritual consciousness. So in the Bhagavatam it explains that you know, we rise above the mode of ignorance. We can conquer the mode of ignorance by the mode of passion. And we can conquer the mode of passion by the mode of goodness. And then it says, once we're in the mode of goodness, if we can become strongly situated in the mode of goodness, and if we can practice those things that are already in the mode of goodness and keep refining them, then religious principles manifest. And religious principles, and it says, of which devotional service naturally follows. Of course, it's not mechanistic, because Krishna is in control. Nothing happens without Krishna's sanction. But it's just explaining that this is like a natural progression of advancement that everybody should follow. Because we know that when you become complacent in the mode of goodness, you can get stuck. Sridharananda Maharaj coined this phrase, or didn't coin it, but I remember in a class he said, the person can become suspended in the whirlpool of any of the stages in of the modes of nature. Someone can become suspended in the mode of goodness. So what I'm saying is that Bali Maharaj was at that point where here's the primary meaning. The spiritual master's primary duty is to take the devotee back to Godhead, to connect them to Krishna. So Bali Maharaj is ready for that. So why is Shukracharya going to the secondary level and saying to him, no, you should actually be concerned with dharma, artha, karma, these secondary levels? Why is he doing that? It's almost like if a student passes all their exams and they're ready now to go to university And the person says, no, no, you go back to high school. I don't want you to go. I read recently also that, I can't remember the context, but the concept was that everything should be allowed to mature. Shishi Radhika Kulananda Ki Jai Sitram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai Shishi Gaurani Tai Ki Jai Skangaravrinda Ki Jai. Everything should be allowed to mature until its full growth is achieved. And, you know, that's the duty of any authority, is to help the person that they're in charge of progress until they reach their full potential. So that requires that the person, that the authority, is not envious of who they're in charge of. Because if they're envious of who they're in charge of, then they won't want to see them. Certainly they won't want to see them exceed themselves. That's the nature of envy. And this is why also Chanaka Pandit has explained that in raising a child, then the parents need to be treating the child as a prince or a princess in the really early years. Just the flow of love should be there. And then from 5 until 15, the character building, and there should be discipline. That's where the role of an authority comes in, shaping the character of the child. And then at 15, 16, around that time, of course, it's not that once the date on the calendar is achieved, you just put a new hat on. There's transitions, of course. But at that age of the person being a young lady or a young man, there's another transition where the parent becomes their friend and relinquishes the role of being the authority, which they'd been holding up to that point. So in order to do that, then, somebody may be attached to being the authority, to being the boss. So that gets in the way. Then the person will not be allowed, or it won't facilitate that person fully maturing. And so that's unfortunate. That becomes unfortunate. So that's why authority must be based on love and not on fear. The authority based on love will always see what's best for that person, what will benefit that person. So the last point that I'll just address is this concept of very soon be bereft of your opulence. This whole pastime of the eighth canto that's led up to this point, it kicked off with Durvasa Muni cursing Indra that you will be bereft of all your opulence. It's the exact same words. If we remember that Indra had become very proud and he was sitting on Airavata, his elephant, and Durvasa Muni garlanded him. And Indra just took the garland off and put it over Airavata, and then Airavata just grabbed it with his trunk and just smashed it. And it was very disturbing to Durvasa Muni, because his goodwill had been taken so cheaply. And so he cursed Indra and he said, you know, you will be, for this offense, you will be bereft of all your opulences. And that was the beginning of the end, in a sense, because the demigods lost their opulences. They lost their kingdom, Airavata, their positions. And but they were very attached to their opulences, because their opulences were material opulences. Very refined, but they were material opulences. And they wanted them back. So they go to the ocean of milk, and they go to Lord Brahma, and they go to the ocean of milk, and they set into motion this whole attempt to get it all back. And then eventually they... anyway, then that's the whole story. I won't go through the whole story. But in this case, Bali Maharaj's opulences, even though he's controlling the whole universe, his opulences are spiritual. Dedication to the truth, humility, surrender. These are spiritual opulences that cannot be vanquished. As it says in the purport, such opulences will never be vanquished, whereas the opulences achieved by one's fruit of activity may be vanquished at any moment. And one other point on that is that Krishna says that Yasyahamana Krishna mi harishe taddanam shane, that his mercy is there when he takes away the opulences of his devotee. But generally this taking away the opulences of a devotee is when, this is called talking about material opulences now, this happens when those material opulences are distracting the devotee from pure devotional service. So then Krishna takes those material opulences away so that they can fully depend on him. If a devotee has material opulences but is engaging them in Krishna's service, and is not distracted by them, then Krishna doesn't take them away. Of course, in this case, it's stated that Krishna's just giving an example. Bali Maharaj is one of the 12 Mahajans, and Krishna is engaging him to provide the example of someone who is fully surrendered, and is just an instrument in Krishna's plan. But in other places it's explained that if a devotee has opulences but they're not proud, then they're to be considered even higher than a devotee who has opulences and is proud, and then has to have those, you know, Krishna makes that arrangement for those opulences to be taken away. It's better that the devotee has opulences and isn't proud. That's the preferred situation. Okay, I'll leave time for questions.